If you want to follow the connections between banks and powerful people and organized crime figures, you go into law enforcement or journalism, right? Neither of those fields were the right answer for one Mark Lombardi, an artist who died of a reported suicide 15 years ago. His intricate works of art showed patterns and connections between people and organizations. They drew attention from intelligence agencies, too. All of this is laid out in a new book by Patricia Goldstone. She's the author of the book Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Patricia Goldstone is a rare combination of journalist and playwright. She worked as a reporter for the Los Angeles Times and has published articles in a number of other news outlets. She's also the author of two other books. Patricia Goldstone, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeff. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
It's good to have you. A few words probably need to be said first about Mark Lombardi's major works. They really look like nothing else in the art world.
That's true. Mark was a totally unique figure. He was a conceptual artist, which basically means he drew ideas and not water lilies. Some people consider him to be the first great artist of the 21st century. He's unique in the art world because he used interlocks to create his art. Now, interlocks are a form of flowchart used to trace overly cozy relationships between boards of directors. They're commonly found in accounting and in certain forms of litigation, but they are extraordinary to find in the art world. Mark used them to draw what amounts to a continual visual history of the interconnections between intelligence, organized crime, corporations, and governments in the darker recesses of the shadow banking industry that we've heard so much of since 2007. He was particularly interested in tracing things like money laundering and tax evasion, and he was really way ahead of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange in releasing a very wide swath of extremely uncomfortable information to the public, a form of visual WikiLeaks, literally hanging it on a wall for everyone to see.
Almost journalism by flowchart was the feeling I had when I looked at it.
Well, it's a hybrid. He was actually very interested in doing narrative. He was very verbal, very, very, very bright, very articulate. And he began his drawings with the ambition of turning them into a book, but he found that there were so many players that he said he couldn't keep the narrative straight in his head, so he started drawing it out.
Interesting. So a desire to be almost like a journalist or to actually do the kind of work of a journalist ended up turning into artwork with this series of, and it's really hard to describe, but a series of bubbles, basically, that had people's names and positions and then a bunch of arrows connecting them to other people. And end up with, he made them very beautiful. There are some globular shapes of great large flow charts and just some amazing work there altogether.
Well, exactly. I mean, because it's an interesting story. It's one of the things that surprised me greatly when I was researching the book. One of the reasons Mark became a conceptual artist was that he wasn't really that skilled as a painter, and his drawing skills were rather weak. So the whole basis of conceptual art is, as I said, to draw ideas. And in the canon of conceptual art, the idea is more important than the execution. But Mark's execution, for a number of reasons that I go into in the book, was actually meticulous enough to withstand legal scrutiny. And the way that he worked was really fascinating because he would read his way through literally hundreds of books to research the flow of hot money, and he used largely published material by well-respected academics and journalists, with one very important exception I go into in my book. He would take these books, digest them, and boil them down to bullet points of academically annotated information, which he compiled in thousands of 3x5 file cards. And the information in the cards was basically what went into the circles that you see in his drawings, which represent major players and the connections between them. When he began to draw, he which he did on huge sheets of paper on the floor of his generally tiny and ill-lit studios, he would arrange these index cards in a narrative design on the floor next to the drawing he was composing, much like a film director uses a storyboard. And that's what creates those designs that you see. You know, and he used the arcing lines to create a kind of symphonic movement in the drawings, which give the eye a certain direction to look into.
I wondered how he could commit these to paper until you talked about the cards. I was thinking that he would have to make little bubbles and then, and then out comes the eraser and he starts all over again. But he had this all meticulously mapped out, it sounds like, before it ever got drawn.
Yes, absolutely. He was very rigorous in his research methods. And also knew his stuff in terms of art. You know, he was working to overcome his own deficiency, which is one of the fascinating things I found about him. And he compensated by really meticulously working out the philosophical underpinnings of his work. And remarkably, those are very similar to the philosophical underpinnings of the Internet, so it's not an exaggeration that he sussed out the sweet spot where abstract art and computer science intersect.
There's some great stuff to learn yet about Mark Lombardi. The book is called Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Patricia Goldstone wrote it and is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Patricia. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and playwright Patricia Goldstone, the author of a new book about the late artist Mark Lombardi, dead of a reported suicide 15 years ago. He created amazing artwork that showed interlocking relationships between things like banks and powerful people and organized crime figures. The book is called Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. You may join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You talked about the painstaking research, Patricia. So the stuff that Mark Lombardi ended up putting up on the wall, was it generally accurate? I mean, were these connections bulletproof in their ability for him to be able to prove them?
Yes, as I said, he relied for the most part on previously published material. I mean, he worked very much in the way that a historian or a biographer would work. So he annotated everything on, depending on who you're talking to, between 14,000 and 40,000 index cards, which look very much like the bibliography of any published book. And interestingly enough, and this is one of the extraordinary things about him, he was also taught how to do interlocks in the mid-80s by one of the lawyers who deposed Adnan Khashoggi, who was one of the major middlemen in Iran-Contra and BCCI. So his research was quite professionally grounded.
One of the more surprising things about Mark Lombardi is actually a post-mortem thing. He was dead 18 months before 9/11, and then there was a telling moment just after 9/11 when FBI agents came to the Whitney Museum in New York. What were they looking for?
Well, that's a very interesting question. As I discovered in the course of researching the book, this hadn't been made public before. The FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Department of Defense, and the Office of Naval Research all had to study his work in the wake of 9/11. They were looking for clues to terrorist social networks, which is one of the things he traced, and they were also looking for traffic analysis tools. For example, the FBI was really very interested in the relationship between Khalid bin Mahfouz, who was the banker to the Saudi royals, and certain Islamic charities in Virginia that were allegedly funding al-Qaeda and that the FBI raided in 2002, a couple of years after Mark's death. That's a subject that Mark studied extensively in one of his drawings, George W. Bush, Harkin Energy, and Jackson Stevens, And that's a drawing that actually disappeared off to Germany shortly after his death. The FBI went to the Whitney to view one of his BCCI drawings, and I'm told they asked to remove it. His mother told me before she died that she was always bothered by the fact that the FBI knew exactly where his work was.
Interesting. And BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, was the subject of a scandal and disgrace. And so that apparently was a large part of his focus.
Yes, it was actually the center of his work. BCCI, as your listeners may or may not recall, was a huge bank. I think at its height it spanned over 80 countries. And it billed itself as the Bank of America for the Third World, but in fact it was the CIA's first global money laundry. BCCI was connected to the subprime crises of the 70s and 80s and was officially closed down in the 90s. But Mark, throughout the course of his drawings, which it's important to remember all interconnect, Mark traced its genesis all the way back to a trove of stolen World War II plunder. And I was amazed at how huge the sum was and how thoroughly it had been laundered through other banks and entities.
And, for the folks who are still trying to latch onto the story, this was the collapse of BCCI brought down the likes of people who had been heretofore quite upstanding figures in politics and diplomacy, like Clark Clifford was probably the major figure to come down with BCCI.
Mm-hmm. He was the prime facilitator of BCCI in Washington. But interestingly, both Clark Clifford and Robert Anderson, who was Secretary of Defense at the end of World War II and was a Texan, was also caught in the fallout from BCCI. Both Anderson and Clifford are central connections in the BCCI drawings, and both of them were also present at the creation of a trust made of this World War II plunder back in the 1940s.
So you mentioned the books he read and the printed material that he relayed to, but did Mark Labarde have connections or sources like a journalist would have? I mean, I have to believe it. Some of the people might have looked at his art and might have contacted him and said, you know, there's actually more to it than you know.
Well, Mark, again, is, I think, totally unique in art history in that he actually began to conceptualize what would become his major work when he was recruited by a prominent politician in Houston, where he lived for many years, to become part of an investigative salon that she and other people were involved in. They were digging into the subprime and oil-related scandals that were destroying the Texas economy at the time. But these scandals were also interlocked, if you'll pardon the expression, with the Iran-Contra funding trail. So Mark, at that time, was given a large stash of internal memos and other primary documents by one of the participants in these scandals, and those documents would be a prize for any serious historian.
Absolutely. We're talking about Mark Labarde, the subject of Patricia Goldstone's book, Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Labarde. So let's come back to the beginning. Where did Mark Labarde come from, and what led him to be him?
Mark was, again, amazingly, a working-class guy from Syracuse, New York, with no training in finance. He had a bachelor's in fine arts, and that was all. He was a very socially engaged intellectual from a very early age. I mean, at age 12, he was fascinated by the details surrounding the Kennedy assassination. His sister actually gave him a copy of the report for Christmas, and he never finished it because he disagreed with it so violently. But that was a seed for some of his work. He went to Syracuse University, became a member of SDS.
Students for Democratic Society?
That's correct. And then became the research assistant for, again, a very politically engaged mentor, Jim Harafis, who was known in the art world for his revolutionary exhibitions. And Harafis hired Mark as his chief researcher for a project called From Teapot Dome to Watergate, which kind of traced connections in the oil business to the Watergate scandal over a period of about 50 years.
And we should point out that Teapot Dome was a major scandal during the administration of an earlier president, Warren Harding, who died in office in 1923. So connections between a couple of presidencies that were largely regarded as failures. Before we get into the work, though, I mean, Mark, in his background, his family called him Mighty Mouth. Why?
Well, he was very opinionated, to put it mildly. But, he was self-taught. And I think in the manner of a lot of autodidacts, he liked holding forth. And he was interesting to listen to. But once he started, it was hard to stop him. And he would tend to override anybody else in the room just by the force of his personality, and especially later in his life by the sheer volume of what he knew.
Which was considerable. I mean, so is this a guy who had trouble finding his people, finding the places that he fit in best?
I think that's a really good assessment of him. He was, he was extraordinarily bright, and I think people like that always feel a bit out of place. He wanted to be an artist more than anything else. He didn't really come from a family that had the kind of privileged background that eases your way into the art world. He had to really struggle to invent himself. And that's one of the things I found most compelling about him. He was a totally original product of his own imagination and mental force.
Hard to imagine anybody else quite like him. We're talking about Mark Lombardi again in the book Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Patricia Goldstone wrote it, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And if you have some thoughts and comments on the subject, you're welcome to join in at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. A little aside here about conceptual art. Do we know when the term first came into use and whether it was something that Mark could even apply to his own art as he left Syracuse and headed off for the world?
I think he certainly studied it because he was a voracious reader and would study anything and everything if it had the remotest connection to anything he was interested in. Conceptual art came into being in the late 60s and early 70s. It was an outgrowth of abstract art, but the central premise of conceptual art is that the idea is more important than the execution of the piece itself.
Yeah.
So what Mark came up with, in about 26 monumental drawings and an untold number of smaller preparatory sketches, which became exhibition pieces in and of themselves and collector's pieces, is this huge concept of a financial system of systems operating beneath the surface of the world's legitimate economy, but reaching up and connecting to it. And that's the overarching idea behind his work. I think I mentioned before that all the drawings connect with each other through key middlemen or through timelines. So they form a kind of 360-degree panoramic vision of some of the more disturbing, I think you would say, underpinnings of realpolitik.
So if you collect Mark's drawings, you will have a drawing on one wall that has a person in it who's going to be on the wall behind you, for example.
Not necessarily.
Mm-hmm. But certainly in the next one, maybe.
Theoretically, yes,
mm-hmm.
You could.
Mm-hmm.
But so many of the drawings have disappeared into museum holdings or private collections that it's actually rather difficult to do that. I mean, there are computer scientists who are trying to do that very thing, but they're more interested in reconstructing his work as a form of artificial intelligence. He's been very widely studied in the computer industry for a number of reasons.
Artificial intelligence?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, there is a computer scientist in Germany, for example, who is trying to deconstruct his drawings into a form of hypertext, which means that you can click on a name in theory and bring up the whole history of that individual through all of the drawings and through all of the connections in the drawings, and the idea is to relate it to what's going on in the present day. But again, it's been very difficult for this computer scientist to complete this project because he cannot get access to so many of the drawings.
Wow. What's the problem with the access to the drawings?
Well, again, they've been privately collected.
Mm-hmm.
They're also very, very difficult to photograph, to reproduce in a way that's readable.
Oh, true. The ones I did find on the internet, it was a real trick to try to get them big enough to be able to zoom into the actual balloons that contain the names of people.
I cannot tell you how much eyesight I have lost in the course of doing this book.
I fully believe that. You know, I should point out that there are pictures in the book of Mark Lombardi and some key moments in his life, but the first picture is actually of his business card, which reads, Death-Defying Acts of Art and Conspiracy. So Mark knew exactly what he was up to. Let's talk about where he went after Syracuse, though, because he went to Texas, of all places. How did he end up there?
Good question. He followed Jim Harris down. Jim became the director of the Houston Museum of Contemporary Art, and he hired Mark as his curator, which was a plum position for a young man just getting out of undergraduate school. And Mark was a great curator because he was such a good researcher. But Mark, who had a rather volatile personality, got into a run-in. According to a note I found in his personal files, it may have been with a member of the Bush family, and he was fired from CAM, which devastated him. And that's sort of when he went underground and began the research for what became his major works of art, which took him a good 10 years.
CAM being the Contemporary Art Museum of Houston?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So he ended up hitting a bit of a bottom point in Houston, it seems like.
Yes. He did bottom out there, but I think in many ways that's what forced him to find himself as well, you know, swimming around in the dark waters, so to speak, and continuing to struggle to pull this big idea out of himself.
Interesting. Houston was a great place to get a look at the oil industry at the
Certainly.
Peak of its power at the time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also at the interlocks between the Saudis and the oil industry, because there's a part of Houston, a very beautiful part, that's been quite well colonized by the Saudis, and they had many, many interconnections with the major banks and businesses and law firms in Houston itself, and that's all part of what Mark drew. He actually did a walking map, a sort of political geography of downtown Houston. It's quite fascinating.
I can't think of anybody's mind who worked quite the way that Mark Lombardi's did, or at least got expressed in the way that Mark Lombardi's did.
No, this is
that makes him unique.
Book.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I've never run across anyone like him before. And the more I talk about him and think about him, the more I really admire him.
Had you met him at all while he was alive?
No, never.
Okay.
Never. I wish I had.
Well, let's talk about his personal life just a bit more then, because you describe him as having a schizophrenic approach to love. In what way? I mean, how did that express itself?
Well, to love, not life. I think his governing mode was really ambition, and that does not create tidy relationships as a rule. Mark was schizophrenic in his approach to love, and that he hungered for a stable relationship. But he did everything to sabotage those relationships. He was married to a wonderful woman for a very long time. I interviewed her in the course of doing the book, and I developed a tremendous amount of respect and liking for her. But he was very attractive to women, and, you know, the art world does not breed constancy.
So we hear. So he did marry Day Barlow in 1980, and you point out some connections to the actual wedding date. What were they?
Yes. You're talking about Michele Sindona there, I believe.
But some other things that happened in his life, I think, on that same date. In different years. Okay, well, not something that stuck. Let's move on. I want to talk about Sissy Farenthold, who she was, and how she influenced Mark Lombardi's life.
Well, Sissy Farenthold was the politician who noticed his work and recruited him to become part of this investigative salon. And Sissy Farenthold is a very important figure in Texas politics, a very glamorous figure, who at one time ran for the vice presidency of the United States in the early 70s.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. The book is called Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Back to talk more with Patricia Goldstone about Mark Lombardi's life. And if you'd like to join us with some discussion of Mark Lombardi and his works, join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the exchange with Patricia Goldstone and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the journalist and playwright Patricia Goldstone, who once worked as a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. She's the author of two books before this current one. It's about the artist Mark Lombardi, who drew, well, you could say he drew. It's more like he wrote with lines. Imagine the flowchart of any organization times 1,000. Mark Lombardi did that by just showing the connections between people, and sometimes these are people involved in organized crime and banking and politics, and showed all their interconnections with each other in his works. The book is then called Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi. Patricia Goldstone wrote it and joins us on the exchange, and you can too, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about Sissy Farenthold, who was a major figure in Texas politics, actually had been nominated for the vice presidency of the United States as a Democrat. And how did their paths cross?
Well, through the art world. There are many interesting people on the boards of directors in the art world, and Sissy was on the board of the Rothko Chapel, which is where Dave Barlow and Mark Lombardi were married in 1980. And Sissy Farenthold was, she shone a bright light on some very uncomfortable financial activities in Texas. She was the main driver behind uncovering the Sharpstown banking scandal in the 70s and others. She's considered something of a rebellious figure. I think she's called the melancholy rebel by some of her admirers. And she has a very strong commitment to revealing some of these nefarious connections. So she was working, as I said, on trying to find the connections between the subprime crises and also researching the Iran-Contra funding network and where that might lead. And it ended up leading into the later investigation on BCCI, which then became a hot topic for her investigative salon, which Mark continued to be a member of until the early 90s. And then just as John Kerry's Senate Investigating Committee on BCCI was winding down, this would have been between 94 and 96, and it's very interesting if you read the committee reports, which I did, Mark turned out a body of work at white-hot speed. These were the first of his big drawings that in effect answered some of the questions that Kerry's committee said it lacked the time and the resources to answer.
So this well-staffed Senate committee couldn't come up with the information about BCCI, and yet Mark Lombardi, working more or less by himself with existing works, was able to pull it together.
Yeah, he was kind of like the smart kid in the back of his class who keeps shooting up his hand and saying, hey, I know the answers.
Uh-huh. That's amazing. What was his first big splash in the art world, and was it seen as art? I'm curious to know what some of the critical reactions to it might have been at first.
Well, his first big splash came when he won a competition in Houston that was adjudicated by an old friend slash competitor of his from Syracuse, a man who's now a very, very well-known curator, Paul Schimmel. And he had a solo exhibition shortly thereafter, which was attended by many of the great and the good in Houston. And he got quite a bit of acclaim and press out of that and ended up moving to New York shortly thereafter.
When you mentioned, well, a couple of interconnections here, we're starting to make our own interlock here, but I'm just...
One does that. It's rather like Game of Thrones.
It is. I could just see how all this works. But just thinking about the fact that, so here he was in Houston, and you mentioned the Bush family briefly before. He was interested in financial institutions. He did apparently do some work on the savings and loan scandal. I wonder if he ended up running across Neil Bush of the Bush family, another one of George H.W. Bush's sons, who was implicated in issues with Silverado Savings and Loan, I think the name was.
Well, yes. One of his large drawings, which was in this very solo exhibition that I was telling you about, is a Silverado drawing. If I'm not mistaken, it's actually a verso, which means there's a drawing on one side and you flip it over, and there's a drawing on the other of Lincoln Savings, which is, of course, Charles Keating.
Ah, mm-hmm. The other major figure there in the savings and loan scandal. Any idea how long Mark Lombardi spent, A, pulling the information together and putting it on cards, and then, B, working on the final piece itself?
Well, it's a little bit hard to research that, but I'm estimating in my book that he began the research for it sometime in the mid-'80s and then produced his first big body of work between 94 and 96. And then after that, he would have done another 10 to 15 monumental drawings, mm-hmm. and a great number of small ones, because he did preparatory sketches for all of his major works. And then his masterpiece was actually his third BCCI drawing, the third version of BCCI. And what he did with that, which is so extraordinary, which is that he arranged all of his other drawings on timelines in this one drawing to show exactly how they connected to form one huge financial system of systems and kept feeding into each other, pooling, as it were. Now, that drawing, interestingly enough, was very badly damaged in a suspicious flood in his studio 3 weeks before his death, and some say it caused his suicide.
So where did the flood come from? Is that it's probably part of this, the suspicion and mystery there?
Yes, it is. It came from the sprinkler pipes, and it's actually rather hard for that to happen.
Mm-hmm. So what do you know about? You mentioned that his works are privately held. By whom, and are they ever displayed?
Some of that information is confidential. That's something that dealers keep very close to their vests. The Whitney Museum of American Art has a major holding of Lombardi, I think 12 or 13 large works. The Museum of Modern Art has another large holding. The computer scientist that I spoke of in Germany, Robert Tolksdorf, personally owns 4 of the drawings. Another computer scientist that I interviewed in at MIT had owned some drawings and sold them. I am told there are hedge fund managers that collect his work. There's even a rumor that Neil Bush bought one, but I was not able to substantiate that.
So those are the people who actually liked his work enough to want to collect it, or at least liked it enough to want to buy it so nobody else could see it, maybe.
Perhaps. Found it fascinating for professional reasons. I mean, he had one show in New York. It was his last show at PS1. And the audience was very different from the audience that you get at most art openings, because it was primarily lawyers and bankers, prosecutors, government people, and one of my interviews told me they were all clustered around the drawings and gossiping about them and saying, oh, I knew him. Well, I defended him. No, I prosecuted him. And, you know, it became a bit People Magazine.
I wonder how much of that, though, was like, oh, look, there I am.
Well, always a good question in New York.
Right. So I'm curious to know about about you mentioned the pieces at the Whitney. I believe you said in the book that after 9/11 that the FBI and CIA asked for one of them to be taken down. Was it?
No, the museum refused, I am told.
How well regarded was he in New York once he'd set up shop there?
He was getting major attention. Roberta Smith of the New York Times was one of his early advocates. He was really getting quite a bit of press. And at the time of his death, he was also going to go very public in terms of explaining the drawings, because that was part of the blowback of success, as it were, from the PS1 show.
So let's talk about that death now, because it happened, was it March of 2000?
That's correct. March 22nd, he was found.
And what were the circumstances look cut and dried, I guess, to the investigators, but certainly when you're a figure who deals in the kind of artwork that can potentially draw connections that will at least make people uncomfortable, if not downright angry, I can see how there'd be a certain level of suspicion. But walk us through what the circumstances were and what might raise questions along the way about whether the circumstances are what they appeared to be to the investigators.
Well, I suppose that the circumstances began with the suspicious flood that partially destroyed his masterwork, the big BCCI drawing. But he did manage to reconstruct that within 3 or 4 days of nonstop work, and the reconstruction was in the PS1 show, and apparently he was very happy with it. He was also, I am told, by his mother, who was the relative who was really closest to him and in almost daily contact with him, that he was quite jubilant about the success that he was enjoying, and also about his relationship with his then-girlfriend. He apparently told her that they were moving in together, but this is where the story gets very murky. According to her, they had broken up some weeks, perhaps a couple of months before, and she called the police on the night of the 22nd from the Whitney Museum, from a big opening there, because she said she had a sudden overwhelming presentiment that he was dead. So I actually began my research by getting hold of the police reports themselves through a friend of mine in a homicide division in New York. And when I looked at them closely, there were a lot of things that didn't really ring true. I mean, for example, the phone call didn't really come in until 5 to midnight. A time of death, which is a standard part of this type of procedure, was never established. And establishing death by hanging is itself quite a controversial area of forensic pathology. That and the fact that the police based their rather hasty verdict of death by suicide, they took 2 days to close the case, on the testimony of this one witness who did appear to be increasingly unreliable during the interview process, really made me think quite hard. And I ended up tracking down the two cops who had found him. And one of them, who was a rookie at the time and was quite disturbed by the experience, because he was the one who climbed up and pushed open the transom to Mark's studio, which is how the police got into his apartment. And he found himself staring straight into Mark's face because Mark had been hanged from one of the sprinkler pipes. And he had an open bottle of champagne suspended by a string beside him. And this one cop said to me, you know, I've never seen anyone take a drink on the way out before. So, you know, there are all of those details. And then, of course, there is the exact nature of what is in the drawings, which could cause any number of people to want him dead.
One of the questions I was trying to ask before was, anybody ever threatened to sue him for slander?
No.
Really?
No. No, because his research methods were pretty watertight.
There was a reference in here to the 2000 presidential race, which obviously would have been already underway, at least in primaries, by the time of Mark Lombardi's death, and connections that might have derailed its course.
Yes. You're talking about the George Bush, Harkin Energy, Jackson Stevens drawing. Yes. Yes. There was, it's interesting, there was a small item that came out in an intelligence newsletter around March 12th, 10 days before Mark died, which suggested that the Bush campaign might run into trouble over the Bush relationship with Khalid bin Mahfouz, which is the underlying subject of that one drawing, and how it flowed through this Texas middleman named James Bath.
Was part of the motivation in writing Interlock to bring Mark Lombardi to the forefront? It sounds like he'd receded a bit in the years since his death.
He did, and I think he's a really important figure and deserves not to recede.
There's certainly nobody else like him, as we learn through reading of the book Interlock, Art, Conspiracy, and the Shadow Worlds of Mark Lombardi by Patricia Goldstone, who joined us on The Exchange today. Patricia, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
All right, take care.